You know what you won't get when you support independent media and pledge your support at rabble.ca/donate? No tote bag, no pens, no mugs. It's not a swag thing. Pledging at rabble.ca/donate keeps Rabble's news and views for the rest of us surviving and maybe even thriving. That's rabble.ca/donate. See you there.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
1 year ago, the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear reactor experienced a triple meltdown. A poorly designed reactor, together with a historically destructive tsunami, combined to cause the meltdowns. Heroic sacrifices by workers and firemen saved Japan from an infinitely greater disaster. But the fallout and the continuing effects of the disaster remain significant. Japan is still struggling to clean up what is left of the reactor. Arne Gunderson is the chief engineer of the energy consulting company Fairwinds Associates, and he's going to be speaking at a symposium called The Fukushima Nuclear Disaster 1 Year Later at SFU next week. And he joins me on the phone today from Vermont. Hello, Arne.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What's happening now at the Fukushima Daiichi reactor?
Well, when a nuclear reactor chain reaction stops, the heat doesn't go away. There's about 5% of the heat that hangs around from the decay products. By now, that's well less than 1%, but it's still not gone. These reactors will stay hot for years to come, so they have to be cooled. So the people at Tokyo Electric are continue to pour water into the reactor, the bottom of which is melted, so the water falls through the reactor onto the floor of the containment and gets circulated back. They're building up an enormous volume of contaminated radioactive water and contaminated radioactive filters, and that's the best that can happen. Of course, if there's an earthquake or another tsunami, Tokyo Electric acknowledges that all this pipe is only not seismically qualified, so they have about 2 days to repair it, maybe three, before the meltdown would continue again. So it's not stable, it's just mildly stable, I guess I'd have to say.
And what about the fuel there? Has that been cleaned up?
The biggest problem on site is Unit 4. Unit 4 has spent fuel in the fuel pool with no containment around it, and it's seismically unstable. It's been damaged from previous explosions. So if there's a major earthquake, you know, 7 or more, it's possible that Unit 4 could collapse. And if that happens, there is no science out here. There's nobody who's ever examined what would happen if a nuclear fuel pool collapsed. But Brookhaven National Labs did a study years ago, and a very similar condition to Fukushima, and said that if cooling was lost to a spent fuel pool, 186,000 people would be cancer casualties. So that's the biggest concern, is getting the fuel out of Unit 4.
What kind of damage has the disaster done already to the people in Japan?
Well, it's forced relocation of tens of thousands of people. And, at 1 year, it's hardly a temporary relocation. Some of these people will never get back on their land in their lifetime. Some of these farmers have been farming the land for seven generations and now have to give it up. So there's the social issues, but there's also an enormous amount of contamination, which is keeping some people off the land. And, of course, the Japanese are pushing people back into areas that I believe should not be inhabited until they're thoroughly cleaned. But I think they're increasing the risk of people getting cancer. Now, I was in Tokyo last week, and I had an inspector radiation detector with me, and I just randomly went to five patches of dirt in the city. One was near a kid's playground, one was a crack in the pavement, and I found radiation levels 3 to 4 times higher than what they should be in Tokyo. Pretty much the entire eastern part of the country is contaminated to one level or another. If it's not a personal health risk, like up near Fukushima, it becomes a broad public health risk for the entire country, and it increases the odds of their getting cancer.
When you say the government is pushing people back into areas, what is the government doing?
Well, they've set a threshold of 2 rem or 20 millisieverts above, below which they say it's safe to move back in. But if you look at the Beer Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation report, it shows that at that number, the likelihood of young girls getting cancer is about 1 in 100 for every year that they're exposed. So if you know you've got 100 kids in a grammar school for 5 years, that's 1 out of every 20 kids is going to get cancer at the levels the government considers safe. So I don't think it's safe, and I don't think people should be forced back into those conditions.
How much is it all going to cost to clean up?
Yeah, that's the $64,000 question. Unfortunately, it's a lot more than that. The estimates for the next 20 years are somewhere between $0.25 trillion and $0.5 trillion U.S. dollars. Now, in yen, that's 20 to 40 trillion yen. It's an enormous number. It's a large fraction of their total gross national product. Now, that comes out of Tokyo Electric for a while until it has no more money to give, and then ultimately it's borne by the people of the country of Japan. The net losses from Fukushima far exceed anything they've ever saved over the last 40 years on oil savings because of nuclear. So nuclear power in Japan has been a net loss and hasn't saved them one penny of money.
And I guess we're talking, as you made so clear earlier, about a situation which is completely unpredictable.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, in the best of cases, we've seen the worst. And if there's not a serious earthquake, they probably can gradually, you know, wrestle this bull to the ground. You know, you said something at the beginning that struck me. It wasn't just the tsunami and a poorly designed plant, but it certainly was both those things. But the regulatory climate of regulators that turned a blind eye toward tsunamis. They've known about tsunami problems for 20 years over there. And yet the regulators, even 8 days before the tsunami hit, allowed Tokyo Electric to say, well, there's not enough information to assume that a serious tsunami is going to hit, so we're not going to design for one yet. It's a worldwide phenomena of what's called regulatory capture. But but in Japan, it was certainly one of the causative factors in the Fukushima meltdown.
Now, I know in the early days after the disaster, there were protests by Japanese citizens and people were demanding a different kind of response from their government. Has that continued?
Yes, it has. You know, the Japanese are very polite people and governed by consensus. And what they've got now is probably about 30% of the population is angry. And that's unique in Japan. You know, it's not a majority, but it's a significant minority that is angry and upset with the way the government has handled it. You know, we've had the collapse of one government, the Kan government. Now the next government in is not much more stable either. So it's leading to political instability because a lot of people just don't trust what the government is telling them, and rightfully so. The Japanese really have no basis to trust what their government officials are telling them.
Is the government looking to get out of the business of providing electricity with nuclear reactors?
You know, when I was over there, that's one of the things I talked about. The book we've written in Japanese is called Fukushima Daiichi, the Truth, which was about the accident, and a Way Forward, which was a different path to move forward without nuclear power. And Right now, Tokyo Electric still controls the Diet, which is their legislative body, and they've convinced the legislators that you have to have all these nuclear plants operating. I think, though, there's an opportunity here. Japan is at a tipping point, and it can either go back to the way it used to do things and risk more seismic problems and more earthquakes and tsunamis, or they have the opportunity to change their economy with distributed power generation and smart grids and lots of things. But in the process, they can make some money because, first, they're a very smart country, and two, there's an export opportunity if the Japanese choose to take it, that they could figure out as a country how to have a smart grid, how to integrate windmills and solar and bloom boxes and a whole series of things, and in effect change the paradigm from central station power, which we had in the 20th century, to distributed power, which will be the power generation source by the end of the 21st. Japan's got the opportunity to lead that if they choose to take the opportunity.
Well, it's been very interesting talking to you this morning, Arnie, and we look forward to hearing you in Vancouver next week.
Well, thank you for having me. And one last thing, there's many brave men at the Fukushima plant and a few brave women as well who the world should really consider as heroes, and I hope we all keep them in our hearts.
Yes. Thank you, Arnie.
Thank you.
Arnie Gundersen is the chief engineer of the engineering consulting company Fairwinds Associates. He's going to be speaking at the symposium, the Fukushima Nuclear Disaster 1 year Later, that's going to be held at SFU next week, March 10th and 11th. If you want to find out more about the symposium, you can go to pgs.ca.